attention. I can't get no call to action, but I try and I try and I try.
Hello and welcome to Call to Action, the go-to podcast for anyone trying to make sense of the world of marketing, business and beyond. In an industry that is a minefield of utter bollocks, we aim to capture our heroes and allies from the front line to have a chinwag with. It's like Pokemon Go, with the single but vital exception that it's not a short-term bandwagon of shite. It's brought to you by Gasp, and I'm Giles Edwards. Today I've caught Mimi Turner, which was no mean feat. We've been chasing her since last year's Nudge Stock. She's here, there, and everywhere with the formidable B2B Institute at LinkedIn. She previously held a number of impressive and varied B2C roles, including Director of Strategy, Messaging and Research at the Liberal Democrats, and Marketing Director at Ladbible. But now, luckily for us, she's all in on making the case for brand as a growth driver for B2B businesses. On that, Mimi says, for over 100 years, the advertising industry has developed a highly sophisticated approach to making individual consumers want things. We have an entire media ecosystem that is about targeting, reaching, and engaging consumers and designed to solve their unmet needs. But marketers know a lot less about how to make companies want things. We know a lot less about how to stimulate, serve, and measure the desire for a specific CRM system, a cybersecurity tool, or workflow management platform. In B2B, the marketing conversation becomes about product facts and features because understanding the emotions that drive decision-making is still a black box. Welcome to the show, Mimi.
Thank you, Giles. I'm excited and delighted to be here.
Fantastic. And I know you're fearing these, so should we go straight to the seven quick-fire questions and see how you do?
This could be one of the shortest podcasts we've ever recorded, Giles, depending on the next seven questions. Yes, let's go for it.
Nice. Well, I think I know the answer. Number one is tea or coffee?
Well, both, depending on the time of day. So I'm afraid I can't give a definitive answer to that question.
Okay, I heard a rumor you're on your third cup of tea this morning, but we'll let that pass.
Yes, preceded by one very nice coffee.
Okay, that's fair. Right, number two, you've interviewed both Arnold Schwarzenegger or Colin Firth?
I've interviewed both, yes.
I'm not going to accept any more boths. Right, number three, the Iliad or the Odyssey?
Can I tell you what, like the one line on why those two books are interesting?
Sure.
They're both books about strategy. The Iliad is about how to lose by being focused on just one thing, which was Achilles. And the Odyssey is about having an openness to strategy and adopting different roles. Being the opposite of your authentic self is what the Odyssey is about. And the Odyssey is a book about success and the Iliad is a book about failure. And strategically, they are incredibly resonant and it should be read together.
I'll allow that one then. Number four, target buyers or hidden buyers?
Well, you are placing me in these very difficult things. Like and I think we'll come to this. My dawning belief on this, I think, myself and my colleague Jan Schwartz, who I wish were here, but has been a partner on this work, I'm starting to come to the point of view that you cannot win without hidden buyers, by whom I mean the process people who are process experts when it comes to organizational buying. And we don't think about them at all, but I think you can't win without them. So I would say hidden buyers.
Well, we've got three more. We're going to Dr. Seuss now. The Cat in the Hat or Green Eggs and Ham?
Oh, Green Eggs and Ham. Green Eggs and Ham.
Number six, Roger Martin or Scott Galloway?
1,000% Roger. He has actually basically been a foundational inspiration for my career. So, yes, Roger. And that's not to diminish Scott's incredible range and just the ability to capture and make sense of the zeitgeist. I think he has an incredible outlook. But I think Roger has a set of rules that are utterly resilient around what strategy actually is. And it's amazing that he did that like 30, 40 years ago, and we still think that strategy is a plan, where in fact it's a bet on the future. And I think you can live your life by his rules, and you can be inspired by Scott's vision, but I think you can live your successful strategic life by Roger's rules. And I love working with him on a couple of projects that we've done.
Wonderful. Well, that was a very definite and yet also incredibly diplomatic and kind answer. Perfect. Well done. And then lastly, brand promise or customer promise?
Customer promise. Again, though, this is not a mutually exclusive offer that you're making to me, Giles, because I think that all brands, when they make a promise, they think they're making a customer promise. But when you make a real promise to the customer, you're actually using your communication to articulate the value that you create for that customer. And actually, the majority of brand promises do that. The majority of brand promises tell you something about the brand. But really, a customer promise tells you what your customer actually is going to get out of your process. So I think a customer promise works all the time. Then a brand promise works some of the time. And I think we've got data to show, having rinsed that thesis quite comprehensively across B2B and B2C, that if you're not making a customer promise, you're literally wasting your money.
Absolutely. Again, great answer. I did warn you, though, that these weren't fair questions, and they're intentionally ambiguous.
You did a great job finding those questions, and especially Arnold Schwarzenegger versus Colin Firth, two very different but very interesting interviews.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Very interesting people, for sure. So, listen, Mimi, I mean, that in itself is a nod to part of your, I suppose, your career to date. And as you know, we like to ask every guest about their path to where they are now, finding that often it's rarely a linear one, and I think this will be no exception. So if you would, could you start by telling our audience about your first ever jobs and then your first proper job?
I'm going to just unpick the premise of your question, because there are jobs, and I think proper jobs, which I think that's a distinction that I would say I didn't really observe. There are things you can do that help you make progress on your desired path. And they may or may not be jobs in the sense that they're paid, they pay, but they are certainly, I think, foundational pillars in building capability. And then there are jobs that you do that you think, I don't necessarily want a career in this, but this is how I earned money when I needed to earn money. So I would put them in those two categories. So I think a proper job can involve not earning money, and a real job can involve just a transaction that doesn't help you make progress. So progress versus non-progress is how I think about those two things. And it gives you a couple of levers. So I wanted really badly to be a journalist. But I grew up, you know, my father's a doctor, my mother's a teacher. We were a million miles away from London. I lived in a village. We didn't know anybody. I don't exactly think I wanted to be a journalist when I was younger. But when I came to university, I wrote a few things, and I realized that when you write something for the student paper, you could go into the junior common room and everybody would be reading it. At the same time, there was a kind of a moment that made me really think, this is a thing I can do. And so to make progress on that, which was like, I mean, it's not exactly as ambitious as going to Mars, but it felt like completely unreachable, completely out of reach, except I had a conviction that I would be good at it. And to do that, I did a whole bunch of things that were non-paid. And in self-invented, I invented them. So I did a radio program with a guy called Declan Curry for students in London at Imperial College. And we blithely went around Parliament saying that we were London Students Radio. And would Michael Portillo or Michael Gove or Tony Blair, at that time, do an interview, and politicians didn't realize at the time would always be interviewed by students because students are quite a hard to reach demographic. So it seemed much easier than it ought to have been. And so I did that while I was at university, and it was much the thing that I cared about the most. Even though obviously it wasn't, you know, it wasn't a job of any kind, but I felt like it was a full-time job. And at the same time, I did a variety of jobs at which I was also, I was spectacularly unsuccessful. But I did learn a lot from. So I was maybe the world's worst chambermaid in a very lovely hotel in South Kensington. Like, and the housekeeper was German and very organized and disciplined. You could just see her looking like, how, because I was working through an agency, like, how did they send me this? I was terrible. Like, just, I just couldn't do it. And there are all these girls who come from Dublin from the summer to work, and you started at like 7 o'clock and you finished at midday, and it was really intense, and then you had the rest of the day to yourself, and they were just incredibly efficient, and I was incredibly rubbish, and I was just so bad at it. And I realized that there are lots of jobs that unless you have the unless you build up the skill, you are just naturally bad at it, and that was one of them. And they were really good at it, and I was really terrible. Although I think I still can fold towels. I can fold a towel for you, Giles. I really can. But I can fold a rack out with extreme symmetry. But that's about the only thing I really took away from it, other than realizing that I just would never be able to do this. And I also worked in Burger King, which was an operating process and sequencing job. And you actually work alongside people who are incredibly good at that. They're just incredibly skilled at the process. And when you're incredibly clumsy at the process, you really notice that. And I respected the guys. Like, there were some, the guys at the back of the Burger King on Gloucester Road. Nobody really went to the back, but that's where the deep fat fryers were. And at the end of every other day, they had to clean out the deep fat fryers, which was a really horrible job, when they were Lithuanian or Albanian, and they may well have had some, you know, uncertain immigration status, but they were just absolutely, I mean, they were just like impressive. It was like watching Superman do stuff. So yes, I was very bad at the things that you'd think weren't difficult to be good at, and I was very good at things that I was finding no way of getting paid for, that created both confusion and conviction, I think, in about equal parts, in the early course of career chance.
I really enjoyed that anecdote, especially the nod to the process and how significant it was, I suppose, further back. Were you front-facing? Were you customer-facing in customer service?
Eventually, especially on a Saturday night, when the pub shut, they would put all the girls on the front desk. I'm not sure you can do that now, but that's... So we would just be like trying to upsell, and, you know, would you like a fillet of fish with that kind of stuff? And that was interesting, because you had to deal with a lot of, you know, it was a bit wobbly as an environment. It was a bit wobbly, but on other quiet, and but it was also, it went very quickly, and you were continually, you had to be your extrovert self. And I think Burger King is not exactly waiting, like being a waiter, but I think there's a dimension of hospitality that's an incredibly important component in any kind of leadership role, where you have to be visible to other people. And you certainly rehearsed your spiel like 120 times a night when you're doing the like front of house. But I also, there's an extraordinary aesthetic design pleasure from working in fast food settings, where somebody has done the design thinking about how this process is going to work most quickly. So you put the buns on the grill, the buns move through the grill and they come out. So you've got your tray and you assemble the bottom, and you put the burgers on, you put the bottoms down, then you do the whatever it is, like I think you put the mayonnaise in, and then you put the cheese on, then you put the onions on, then you put the pickle on, and then the burger comes out and you do them, and then you wrap them up, and then you put them on, and then that go on the shelf. And there's just that was a discipline. I enjoy getting better at it. So both are very different. It's much more right brain, the front of house, working out how drunk is this guy exactly? Is he going to throw up? You know, should I meet him for a drink later, as he suggests? I think maybe not. You know, does he want fries with this? Because I want, you know, you get a list of things that you have to upsell in everything. So, you know, there's a certain complexity to deal with.
Yeah, I like the sequencing and the process. And I suppose that's not something you would necessarily think of unless you had experience of that operation under the bonnet, if you like. And so to speak, one thing I find quite interesting and often quite reassuring is how many people I've interviewed over the last 5 years who have, and to use your phrase, experienced a dimension of hospitality. And I think it's again, and probably a nod back to your definition of proper when I asked you the question about proper job is relevant here as well, because I think often people don't really see these past roles and the value they might have had until they're looking at it in the rearview mirror and later on in their career. But I think that hospitality experience where you're serving real people is something that I think would benefit most people working in marketing. I think it's unfair to say that marketers are completely detached from consumers, but I do think a lot of ills that perhaps we'll come to talk about soon probably haven't helped from that detachment that might exist in certain instances.
It's interesting. I mean, I 100% agree. When I was the marketing director of the Health Lottery, I worked with a guy called Rick Bendel, who had been the CMO globally of Walmart, so probably responsible for more consumer activity and spend than virtually anybody else. And then he'd been the CMO of Asda. He said a thing which is, you know, the customer only sees the people that they interact with, and that is the people who work in supermarkets. And we were doing a lot of work in trying to kind of create more traction and more excitement for in-store experiences so that the people who worked in those stores would become ambassadors of the charities that the Health Lottery supported or whatever. And I think that is absolutely the case. For marketing needs to meet the customer end, not the central office end, just like politics needs to meet the voter end, not the political manifesto end. But your other point about hospitality, so hospitality is I think a wildly undervalued skill set that leaders don't know they don't have. I think all leaders should go and become waiters, because as a waiter, you have this very interesting experience. And there's a guy called Will Goddara, who my colleague Jan Schwartz helped to write his book Unreasonable Hospitality, writes about hospitality. And I think that book is really about leadership. Hospitality is a leadership lever. And the more that, you know, AI and better, cheaper knowledge and intelligence and evaluation systems happen, the more important that human dimension of being able to make a connection very quickly becomes. And there is literally nobody who understands how to make a connection with people more quickly than a maitre d' or a waiter, whose job it is, within moments of meeting a complete stranger, to put that person at their ease, to make them feel important, to make them feel in control, to give them status, and to allow them to do the thing that makes them most receptive to buying. And that's a leadership composite, but waiters do it, and waitresses do it in under 3.5 minutes. And some CEOs and leaders don't do it at all, like they never do it. Or at least they don't appear to do it. So I think there's a skill set that we don't value, because we don't really value intangible soft skills. But a soft skill is not soft at all. And intangible skills are where all the differentiated value is.
I think you've hit on a perfect point there. Funny enough, I interviewed Kevin Chesters recently, and he made the same point specifically about politicians and how he wishes there was some way of mandating all politicians to spend a year out in the, quote, real world doing real jobs, which I think would have a similar effect on their ability to connect with people from that hospitality angle. It also reminds me of Rory Sutherland's doorman fallacy, where he, you know, compares a doorman with a revolving door.
Yes. That captures the value of the intangible. And it also captures how it's too late if you don't value the intangibles on their own merit. It's just too late. The story is the doorman is the guy who knows everybody. He knows everybody and everybody knows him. And then somebody from the management consultancy firm say, oh, this is just a cost. Tony's just a cost. Why have we got this cost on our balance sheet when we could just have a door and it would save on the heating as well? And then the door goes in, Tony goes out, and then people go, well, where's Tony? What happened to him? Like, he was the one who always made us feel so welcome. He used to chat to, he knew, and, you know, he used to ask after our children, and I've been coming here for 40 years. And now just some automatic door. There's no welcome. There's nobody who recognizes me and makes me feel special and recognized and familiar when I come through the door. You know something? I think I'll go somewhere else where they still have that thing.
Yeah, but they value the relationship, perhaps. Mimi, so how then, if I give a very brief overview of what we've talked about so far, and the reason I'm going to ask this question is I'm always interested to find the intent behind someone ending up in marketing. So you said, I think your father was a doctor, your mother was a teacher, you were the world's worst chambermaid. That's your words, not mine. You worked at Burger King.
I think I'd still hold the record.
There was obviously an interest in politics. Was there intent to go into marketing? I mean, what did you study at university that might help shine the light?
I studied civil engineering, but largely because my parents really wanted me to be a doctor. And I felt that by the time I'd avoided both being a doctor and being a civil engineer, essentially, that's a humanitarian act. I mean, the number of people who are alive today because I was none of those things. Qualified me for the Nobel Peace Prize. I mean, the bridges that would have collapsed, the people that would have died instead because I didn't notice this or that. And I didn't really like ill people. I felt that those were no-go areas really for me. And it was a very miserable time. Trying to be something that you're not and you don't know how to get into is incredibly lonely. It's just really lonely. But once you find out something that you feel you can do, almost nothing will get in the way of you believing that it's not the biggest leap from being able to do something to be able to be paid for doing that same thing. Hindsight makes everything look as though it was much more linear than it actually is, because it allows us to forget all the things that didn't happen and just assume that the things that did happen were some sort of causal connection. I think your question was about marketing, which I never really had thought of or even understood. I was interested in two things. Journalism is about evaluation and then telling a story around your evaluation of a thing. Journalism committed strategic suicide by failing to understand the challenge of the internet. And I, as a journalist, watched my whole industry collapse. It lost its conviction because we made major strategic errors around giving something away for free on this fancy interweb thing, whereby, because we'll get advertising, and selling something as a physical product for a physical amount. That was a strategic, gargantuan error for which journalism has not recovered. In fact, journalism now is no longer able to control its economic destiny in an online environment because it doesn't control those levers. And, you know, the ad tech stack has been a value destroyer for high quality content creators. So for me, it wasn't marketing exactly. It was strategy, like what are the right strategic decisions to make? And I found that I wanted to be the person around the management table that when somebody said, what should we do? Like, people looked my way. I wanted to be asked the question, what should we do? Because if you believe that what you're doing right now is right, you won't have any reason to change your point of view. Strategy is like being Cassandra. It's like, you know, in the Greek sense, it's like Halley Joel Osmond. I see dead business models and they don't know they're dead. That's how I felt about strategy, and that's what I wanted to do. But to understand that marketing is strategy, when you have product, price, place and promotion levers, that's strategy. That is the whole of strategy. Everything else is operations. And that's what I wanted to, that's the problem I wanted to solve. But it's uncomfortable. Nobody likes strategy. Nobody wants it. Nobody wants that to feel or hear or believe that the thing that we're invested in doing with 99% of our energy is not going to be enough. That's like a rat sandwich.
I feel like there's a couple of threads there. They weren't what I thought they might be. I wondered, actually, from a previous interview, you described the transition between disciplines as both unsettling and intoxicating. So part of me anticipated it was that hunger for new experiences that might have been the driver.
I think that strong emotions like intoxication and fear are quite close together, right? They're quite close together wherever you experience them in the amygdala. So in a situation for which one is not necessarily it's not what you've been doing for the past 15 years. You don't have 15 years of track record in doing it. You're going to feel both of those. Intoxication, if you think you've understood something, fear that you don't understand. And they happen, I think, in about equal amounts. It's not like we feel only one feeling. We feel a combination of feelings. And at any one time, one or other is winning out. So I think I felt all of those things. But I did feel, and this is where Roger Martin, and his book Playing to Win really does crystallize how not to fuck up. I mean, if there was another word, a name for that book, it would be how not to fuck up. And I think his idea of defining the delta of where you want to get to, not selling more stuff, right, or doing more, so that's not a strategy. Like, what is it? What is the bet that you're making on the future, that the future is going to look like this, to which your business has to be appended, and to your business has to follow a different route to get there? That is the opening question. What is your expectation of the future, your winning aspiration? Where can you play? Like, where do you play, and how are you going to win? Like, what competitive advantages are you going to win with? And who do you need to win against? These aren't incredibly philosophical questions. But I think that, I mean, I worked in like a dozen businesses, and I think that they vary very much on the question of being able to visualize who they're competing against and articulate it and look at it really in that face. And so I think there's a lot of variance on how well people adhere to the strategy cascade that Roger Martin sets out. But I think the less variant you are from that that ability to articulate your business in that way, I think the more successful you're likely to be.
Yeah, well said. I think we come from a similar school of thought there. I've always liked the idea that marketing is a game of odds and chances and bets. Only the Sith deal in absolutes, I think Brian McCready said in about episode 6 or 7 of Call to Action. And so how does that play out in a B2B context? We might stumble into some recent work that you've done with your colleague Jan Schwartz.
So I think B2B is a very interesting canvas. And in many ways, our thinking about B2B marketing is like thinking about it's a challenger brand to B2C marketing. And in the jobs that I've done, as it were, and I add as it were, that would be mine. If I had a podcast, I would call it as it were, Giles. And I'd hope you would be one of my very first guests on it. I think that I have always worked in challenger brands. So the health lottery was a challenger brand to the national lottery, by which I mean we had 1% to the national lottery's 99%. Richard Desmond had a lot of challenger brand portfolios. So Channel 5 could have been considered a challenger brand to Channel 4, The Express to The Mail, OK to Hello. He was an expert in challenger brands. Lab Rival was a challenger brand to all manner of much more well-regarded and, you know, much more authoritative media platfors. B2B is a challenger brand because we have a very B2C way of thinking. And the Liberal Democrats obviously are a challenger brand, although now I think that they're, you know, just face making their case for being the main opposition party in this country. But the challenger brands can win when they understand the dimensions that they perform better at than the category leaders or owners. Challenger brands that don't understand that become just brands, like also ran brands. They just become like brands 5 to 8 in a category. They're not really challenging anything. Unless you're challenging, you can only challenge on the basis of something that you own more and own better. I think that B2B is a very interesting discipline because it actually has a bigger sales footprint than B2C. B2B annual sales are something like $18 trillion compared to B2B, which is about $5.5 trillion. But a lot more money is spent on marketing and advertising in B2C, about 10%, compared to in B2B, 0.6%. So there's a lot of headroom for growth in B2B if B2B could understand how to make advertising and marketing more effective. So my colleague, Jan Schwartz, was the global founder of the B2B Institute at LinkedIn. And actually, he persuaded me that to join LinkedIn and to basically because he outlined, you know, this is a winning, you can play to win here. Whereas I realized that in politics, I still, you know, you're still playing to be a different version of third. So that's why I joined LinkedIn, because I think B2B has untapped horizons. And I think it's very, very nascent. The idea that we can, in an auction-based and programmatic environment, reach every potential person in a specific category. LinkedIn has 1 billion professionals around the world. That's new. I mean, that's really, really, really new. It's so new. It's still burning your fingertips new. That's why I think that it's interesting. And that's why I also have a conviction based on a lot of previous career of looking at things that thought they were one thing, but they were really another, which is that maybe we don't, our understanding doesn't, should stop being B2C shaped. That's just a faster horse. The B2B shape of decision making is different. So the piece of work that Jan Schwartz and I did, and we worked with Jamie Cleghorn and his team at Bain, and with Jackie Cutroni and her team at NutriX, is really looking at how does this process actually work? Who is actually making decisions? Because the difference between B2B and B2C is poorly understood. You know, like you talk to people in B2B and they say, oh, well, it's like professional, but it's human, and oh, it's long buying cycles, and it's, you know, complicated equipment, and it's all. And that's all true, but it's just not true enough. The real difference is a group of people have to make a decision together. That's the difference. When I want to buy something, essentially, I just have to suit myself. Like, eventually, I'm suiting myself. I don't have to navigate the political and social complexities of transparent decision-making with colleagues and people in my same organization with whom I have a complex sort of social and a connective tissue. And that makes all the difference. Makes all the difference. You know, if you think about, even if you had to arrange like a Christmas lunch out for you and your team, and then your boss comes and wants to go somewhere else, and you know the team wants to go one place, but your boss wants to go another place, you're in the grip of a kind of, you know, non-trivial political problem, because everyone's going to you, Giles, if they don't get where they want to go. And if you add spending $12 million for a CRM system on top of that, it becomes a complicated thing. So when groups of people make decisions, they decide much more on what's easiest to agree than what individuals think is right. Individuals compromise what they think is right for what's easiest to agree. And B2B marketers are still trying to sell what's best, but we should to sell what's easiest to agree on. What's easiest to agree on is a much different destination than proving that what you're selling is the best.
One thing that really stood out to me when I first read this piece of work, which we'll link to in this episode, so if you're listening, please do read it if you've not already, but was the parallels, and I say parallels in the loosest sense because they are by no means the same thing, as the conversation you might have more prominently in B2C, but I'm sure it applies in B2B, is that people typically satisfy so they don't maximize when they make purchases, which is that they, as consumers, we're more likely, I suppose, in some categories to choose a product that is least likely to be shit over something that's most likely to be brilliant. And there's that kind of element of messing up versus missing out that comes across in your research.
We use brand in B2B and B2C in similar but not exactly the same way. I think in B2B, brand is a kind of decision insurance. You know, in so many of the emerging B2B, say card-based categories, or, you know, signal and data and fourth industrial revolution, you know, large information data set driven businesses, nobody knows who is everybody in a category is, because the category didn't exist until a decade ago. And a decade ago, everybody was in a different job. And so it's not like we grow up knowing, you know, the 15, you know, knowing that there are four versions of male deodorant. It's either Old Spice or Lynx Africa or something else.
Yeah.
That's not how we don't have the mental availability and memory. So in B2C, I think there's a lot of memory-based structures and that are in our own heads. But I think in B2B, as long as the memory is in somebody's head or the conviction is somebody in somebody else's head, that's okay for us, because somebody else knowing about something is shorthand for, if they know about it, it can't be so terrible. It can't, you know, people bought this. The biggest brands in B2B are big because people bought them and it didn't go, you know, they didn't get fired. Nobody ever got fired for buying IBM. Is the trade that really underscores the real anxieties at play when you make professional decision making.
Yeah.
And that was never actually an IBM phrase. It was just what a customer said about it. You never get fired for buying IBM. Boom. I'm satisfied. That's all I really needed to know. That covers off my personal exposure to risk. And that's what I want to minimize when I make a professional decision, my personal exposure to risk, career risk.
Yeah. I suppose in a sense, you talk about anxiety insurance. I suppose in the two different contexts, if we are going to kind of entertain the idea that they're, you know, distinctly different, and of course they are in some instances, B2C and B2B, it's kind of anxiety insurance versus, I don't know, cognitive ease. Phil Barden talks about brands are a no-brainer, in as much as the easier you can make a decision to make for a consumer, the more likely they are to choose that product. And that comes from exposure and familiarity to that brand. So there's kind of very similar heuristics, but they're different contextually depending on the amount of people involved in the decision-making process, perhaps.
Just expand on that a little bit.
Phil's point is science behind why we buy, which studied shopper marketing. showed that the cognitive kind of activity when consumers are exposed to a familiar brand was far less than when they're exposed to a brand that they're not familiar with on a supermarket shelf, for example. And given humans make tens of thousands of decisions a day, we are influenced hugely by decisions which are easier to make. So we're looking to reduce that kind of cognitive ease. The way I've always understood and explained it is it's a bit like when you try a new meat, it tastes like chicken because you're trying to file it away in kind of like a known memory category for when you later recall it. And I think brands operate in a similar way, that they provide this heuristic where familiarity leads to trust, leads to purchase. And I wonder if we're talking about the awareness that brands enjoy the benefits of in a B2B environment, that being a well-known brand is so significant versus being an absolutely better product, that there's kind of a parallel there too.
I think that's absolutely it. I think that is absolutely it. And cognitive ease, the thing is, cognitive ease is fine when you're in a supermarket and you've got to decide which soup am I going to buy. But we don't really bring cognitive ease to, or it might be there, but we don't admit it, to professional buying. We think that anything that's cognitively easy means that you didn't read 67 white papers or come to me with a fully developed view. I can't really go to my boss and say, you know, I think we should spend $6 million on this workflow management process because it's just, you know, I haven't really thought about it, but it seems great.
And I recognize it. Yeah.
I've heard of these guys, but I think we're sophisticated creatures, and we think that if other people have heard of it, and it's well known, a well known brand is always going to be easy because that's group knowledge, right? I'm making a bet on a group's knowledge of something versus I'm taking the risk of my personal knowledge being better than other people's. Nobody wants to take that bet. We don't even want to expose our colleagues to take that bet. One of the interesting pieces of questions in the questionnaire that we did was to ask people, to what extent does you knowing about a product or a vendor matter versus other people knowing about a vendor? If other people knew about it, would you be happy with it? If you knew about it, would you be happy? So unsurprisingly, like 53 and 55% of both the product experts and the buying process experts said, if I've heard of a vendor, I feel better about it, right? I'm okay if I've heard about it. But what was really surprising was as much as 45% of buyers said, well, even if I haven't heard of it, I'm willing to go along with it if other people in the buying group have heard of it. We're much more likely to devolve decision-making influence to a group because we know in a B2B buying process that we are not an expert, right? I'm not an expert in everything. Now, I've been expert in the legal terms, or I might be an expert in procurement, or I might be an expert in the user's experience, or I might be an expert in budgeting, but I'm not qua expert in everything. I rely on other people to have the knowledge to make the decision. That's why B2B buying is a distributed decision-making process in a way that B2C isn't. You know, that's what we're trying to kind of nail. What is the difference that is actionable? And that actionable difference allows you to actually set a strategy about understanding who cares about what, rather than assuming that everybody cares about the same thing.
We interrupt this podcast to announce that we will never interrupt this podcast with ads. Ads that awkwardly nudge you to contact the pod's host, Giles Edwards. Only last week, some pod listening companies did just that, calling for guidance on proper marketing strategy. But we're not asking you to do that. Nope. Anyway, back to the show.
And it's probably the world's simplest idea. I call it the golden circle.
Yeah, golden shower more like. You don't want Simon Sinek, you want a proper marketing chat, don't you? Hang on.
It's interesting, isn't it, how...
Oh, that's better.
...we respond to risk in those settings. Are you familiar with the term bike shedding?
No.
I think its origins precede Richard Shotton's work, but there's a lovely story which I'm very good, Mimi, at retelling stories and losing all the accuracy of the detail. But it was along the lines of group meeting to decide and approve the plans for a nuclear power station. And in short, I think the conclusion was that they approved the plans very, very quickly, or the majority of the plan very quickly, aside from where the employees' bike shed would be situated on this site. Because people weren't familiar with nuclear power stations, no one was really in a position to debate it. But everyone knew about bikes and bike sheds, and it took hours and hours and hours to approve this tiny, relatively insignificant part of the plan.
Interesting.
And yeah, it's interesting in your point about in the B2B kind of buying context that we appear to be quite happy to trust a colleague's bet, I suppose.
Yeah. I mean, we found that this idea of other people's knowledge of a product or vendor was actually more powerful than any of the dimensions that marketers typically think decisions are based on. So it was more important than price. Everybody was willing to compromise and pay more for a product or vendor that other people had heard of. We'll pay more for it because other people have heard for it. We'll actually accept less good products. Like, so experts might think that a particular product was the best, but if they didn't think their colleagues had heard of it, they wouldn't bother to propose it, because not only would they be taking a risk themselves, but they would be asking their colleagues to take a risk to spend some political capital on believing that they were right. And the most catastrophic thing that you can do in the professional environment is ask colleagues to spend their political capital on your idea and then be wrong, because then they share in the failure. And in B2B businesses, I think this is, I was discussing this, the whole idea of buyer groups with Rory Sutherland. We actually had an event and we did a like a kind of fireside, and we were talking about this, and he was saying that the biggest brands win, and nobody ever tells you that you didn't win because you weren't the biggest brand. They make up some excuse about, oh, you didn't have an office in Arkansas, and that's why we had to go with the other guys. No one will really tell you the truth that other people had heard of that other guy, and they're willing to, you know, and that's enough. You know, we found that being well known by the rest of the buyer group was more important than being a better product. It was more important than being a cheaper product. And it was more important than being a product that was championed by experts. And what's interesting about those is that you really come to the conclusion that in B2B, brand is the most important thing. At certain points in the buying process, if other things are equal, the biggest brand will always win. But B2B marketers are not selling as if brand were the most important thing. They're selling, they're spending marketing money as if brand were this, you know, kind of heated steering wheel. It's a nice to have, but actually bottom of the funnel is where you have to spend the money. That's non-negotiable. But the reason that Jan and I and Jamie at Bain were doing this piece of research is because brand is the most important influencer at critical stages of every sales process that's happening now in this quarter. This quarter's sales will be won or lost on brand. And that isn't something that we say enough. And I think that's what I started to come to understand and believe. And not just because we've done this one particular piece of research, but because it's obviously, if you ask salespeople, is it easy to sell if you're a big brand or a small brand? They will tell you it's so much easier to sell if you're a big brand.
We often talk about big brand marketing as doing marketing in easy mode, which I know might upset a lot of people who work at big brands, but for similar reasons.
I'm sure that if you work in a big brand, that you are, you know, you have to work as hard, if not harder, and they attract incredibly strong talent and all of those things. So it's unlikely that big brands are making big mistakes. But I still think that big brands win in B2B almost by accident. Because our research really looked at what are the things that help a group to make a decision, and who are the two distinct groups within almost all B2B enterprise-level purchases who have different objectives and care about different things. So we looked at the process experts, legal, finance, procurement, operations, who are not targeted. Like less than 30% of our whole sample had seen any kind of advertising that was targeted at the concerns of risk mitigating process buyers. But everybody had seen advertising that concerned the interests of product users or product experts. But the hidden buyers that we call the risk mitigators are very unaddressed. They're almost invisible in the buying process because we don't realize how much influence they have. But the power of saying no is actually much more powerful than the power of recommending. So mostly tech advertising, which is because we looked at the tech category, is targeted at product experts so that you can get on the consideration set. And we have this idea that the funnel is the same as the B2C funnel, where you go from consideration, from awareness to consideration to evaluation and then purchase. You know, that's the flow. But only product experts go through that. The hidden buyers have a completely different set of checklists. And just being on the consideration list is because you can do the job is not enough. You've got to be safe enough, risk, you know, perceived as a risk mitigator, perceived as reliable, be a brand that peers respect in order for the process buyers to think that you're safe. And for them, brand and safety are one and the same. So one of the most important components of a B2B buying purchase is to be approved by legal, finance, HR, and procurement. And brand matters more to them than it matters to the people that we're routinely targeting, the target product users. Brand matters more to the people who are targeted least in B2B.
I think that's brilliantly articulated. I'm certainly going to snip that and use that in the promo, Mimi, because it's rare to hear it articulated so well. I suppose in many senses, brand is less heated steering wheel and is more steering wheel.
Yes, that's a perfect way of saying it. And you know, to your point about what you're striving to do in this podcast is to make marketing seem more winnable, right?
Yes.
This is a winnable strategy. My whole life has been about trying to take these very complicated big, you know, data sets and like lots of, you know, and make it something that's winnable. If I just said to you, target hidden buyers and you will be more likely to win than if you don't. And the big brands do this by accident because Joe from procurement has already heard of Salesforce. He's like, yeah, they seem legit. That's what his, you know, that's what his reptile brain says when evaluating the risk. And so the seems legit, which I think is a very loud Bible phrase and not really a LinkedIn phrase, but, you know, seems legit.
I like reptile brain as well, but go on.
Yes, sorry. No Jays from procurement were consulted in.
No.
Specify.
Other brain types are available.
Other brain types are available.
Well, just not in procurement.
but in, you know, the fact that brand matters most to the people who are targeted least also explains why the biggest brands win so big. They win big by accident because they're so big that everybody has heard of them. So that's what is the winning dimension. And if you look like at a category like cloud, 66% of the value of that category is in the top three vendors, right? Because the biggest win massively better. It's like in Glengarry Glen Ross, the winner gets a sports car, the runner-up gets a set of steak knives, and everybody else gets fired. That's that. If you know, if you want to just play the game, those are the rules. Well, understanding the value of targeting hidden buyers with messaging about reliability, safety, trust is that you win an unfair advantage. And you know, we cannot all play the game when the rules are inviolable. We need to be able to change the rules to win. Being a challenger brand is about changing the rules to serve the the place that you can win in. And it's like in Moneyball, I think in B2B, we have been buying players. We buy the biggest business brands because they look like they do the most stuff, like the best players look like they do the most stuff. But in B2B, if we want to be bought, we have to buy runs. That means we have to buy votes in the buying group. In the buying group, we have to win a vote from every category. And in order to do that, we need to understand what the different categories are and who cares about what. And that's actionable. You can put a thoughtful strategy around maximizing your opportunities to win, even if you're not one of the biggest brands. And that is, it's not like a massive gap, but it's certainly doable. It's, and, you know, the impossible, the, you know, impossible things should not be spent, shouldn't spend time thinking about them, but we should try and spend a lot of time thinking about possible things. And I think this is possible. I think it's possible to win in a different way.
I think, again, just to reiterate my previous point, I think the way you've articulated it is so clear and so wonderfully done. I've had previous conversations here, and quite rightly, about how I don't think the semantics of marketing helps when we know that awareness is so significant, and perhaps calling it future sales is a way to kind of get ears pricked slightly. But I do think understanding hidden buyers adds a really, really solid layer to that same conversation, and clarifying that the big brands almost win by accident because they are perhaps similarly distracted by whatever we might be distracted with is a really nice way of realizing and justifying exactly how they are winning via the same awareness war. Given that one of the, you know, your main roles of the B2B Institute at LinkedIn is to help CMOs get more money, or brand money specifically, from their CFOs, what, I know that's challenging for marketers, and I know it's challenging for people listening to this podcast who I believe to be predominantly B2B marketers. How else can they add weight to that argument inside their businesses?
Well, I think you're right that this is the preeminent argument. And I think if this piece of work moves anything forward, I think for myself, I think for Jan, I think for Bain, I think for NewtonX, who do a lot of B2B work. Jamie Cleghorn is the partner in their B2B practice, and Jan is obviously the global founder. I think what this does is makes the value of brand immediate as opposed to a future good. You know, brand is not a thing for future Homer. You know, brand is for right now. And I think that that's maybe an area where it has been more difficult to make that case, the case for future good to a CFO versus right here, right now. Right here, right now, I think, is this quarter, which is the domain of concern for many a CFO. And I think, you know, easier to win by doing X. And I think, you know, we're at the beginning of this process, and we're obviously going to do more work, more about hidden buyers, and think more deeply about how to kind of surface their value and make it really clear. Because there's, I think, that there might be something to think about the power of vetoes. Being able to say no might be more powerful than being able to say, have a think about these four vendors. Being able to say, yep, yes, no, yes, is an incredibly powerful thing. And it's got nothing to do with the product capability. Yes, yes, no, it's got nothing to do with product features or product capability or product innovation or any of those things. That's a very important piece of understanding, and that can affect how we perform right now. Might be the case. But it's incredibly helpful and interesting for me to feel that this resonates with you, because I think you've probably listened to so many different marketers, especially in the discipline of B2B, which I think we should start calling, you know, B2B marketing is buyer group marketing. If we start to think of it as some version of B2C marketing, we will already go wrong. We will already be several degrees off the bearing. If we start to think about buyer group marketing, then we have a chance of starting out on the right path. B2B marketing is buyer group marketing. In order to have a strategy, you have to have a strategy for the buyer group. In order to have a strategy for the buyer group, you've got to understand who is within the buyer group and their different domains of expertise. Product expertise is one domain, but it's only one of the other of two domains. The other is buying process experts. buying process experts are probably the least thought of and least sexy and least considered decision makers in the buying process. But when we looked at every tier of the rapid, the inputting, the recommendation, the approval and the decision making, they had between 50 and 60% of the decision making influence. The hidden process buyers control the process of influencing what's bought. Buyer group marketing forces you to think about that, whereas B2B marketing doesn't force you to think about it at all. And I think that that's why, you know, if we can do anything, it's to try and get the idea that buyer group marketing is B2B marketing, and B2B marketing is nothing other than understanding the buyer.
Yeah, amazing. Bang on. I'm mindful, Mimi, that I've kept you longer than I said we would already. So I feel like I should move to listener questions.
Oh, well, I'm in your hands and I'm good for time. So that's however you'd like to.
Oh, good.
Good for me.
Brilliant. Well, there's a couple of points I'd quite happily dig into further. So let's get to listener questions in case any of those come up.
Yes.
So asking the general public for their opinion, be it on Brexit or boat names, is notoriously fraught with danger, but that's not stopped us asking. The first question is from Elliot. Elliot says, do you think the more targeted mediums that tend to be used in reaching B2B audiences are overly influencing the narrower messaging being put into them by B2B marketers?
So I have quite strong opinions about this.
We like strong opinions.
Yeah. One can use targeting for any message. And if you are thinking about a category of buyers, let's say I'm selling dental x-ray equipment to dentists or the people who run dentists, whatever, dental practices, then that is the category. That's the category that matters. And to be able to reach all the people in that category and all the reach I need, I don't think that's narrow targeting or not targeting. Being able to identify the people who form the category that you require is the whole ball game, and being able to reach every category by the people who matter in that category might not mean that you are reaching a lot of people, but you are reaching the people who matter. And I think you can flex on either side of that. You can reach those people with very, very specific product offers or product-related buy now messaging, or you could reach them with all the right kind of information about what you ought to do and, you know, how to feel about their company or your company, or how, you know, what the promise that you're making on behalf of your product is. I would challenge the premise of the question to say that reaching the people who matter with the messaging that matters to them is actually the important thing to do. And unlike cars, where Aston Martins are famous, not just because drivers of Aston Martins think that Aston Martins are famous, but because everybody else who doesn't drive an Aston Martin thinks it's the sexiest car in the world. Within dental x-ray technology, that everybody else is the group of people who buy dental x-ray machines or who are involved with dentists, as opposed to everybody. So I think on balance, the answer is slightly, I disagree with the question. I don't fully agree.
Good answer. Fantastic. Question two is from Anya. Anya's referred to an old Dave Trott memo, which, funnily enough, I also saw do the rounds on social media recently. So she says, an old Dave Trott memo was shared recently highlighting the importance of being different. It definitely did use the word different, by the way. I'm adding this now. I think we should also use the word distinct for how I understood that memo. In everything from creative to media, do you have evidence to suggest that this is important with B2B buyers today?
Or distinctiveness?
Well, I think, to be honest, I think when this memo was written, I think that different was used to cover both bases, and I think we would suggest that's incorrect in how we understand it today. So I interpret this question as being different in terms of media choices, as well as creative, and also for distinct. When we talk about distinct, it's often distinct via copy, any kind of visual or verbal or sonic cues. But I'm interested in the nod to media here, and being distinct in media choices.
You know, I don't know the answer to this question. I don't sound like a really good expert on this. I think it was maybe about 6 months ago, I felt like my whole LinkedIn feed was like, LinkedIn marketing was talking about distinctiveness versus difference, and everybody was arguing about two things. And the problem for me is that while I can grasp these very, you know, on a conceptual level, I have very strong insight. This kind of insider marketing speak about two words that are quite similar. And if I tried to explain to my mother what difference and distinctiveness are, I just feel like I would lose her interest. I would lose interest in the conversation. And it just felt like a very tight conversation. And I'm sure that many of the people who are experts are absolutely right about whatever point of view they have. But I would say that when you're talking about media, we're really talking about messaging. What is the job of our brand messaging, right? And I think that and this is a thing that Dave talks about a lot, which is the job, and I think the job of creativity is to be remembered. So we talk a lot of flannel, and I would use a different word if I were on the podcast, but we talk a lot of stuff that, you know, it rhymes with rank about creativity. And the job of creativity in advertising is one thing. It's to remember the effing brand. If you don't remember the brand, after it doesn't matter how creative you are, your job is to use creative mechanisms to make you identify the brand with a, so that at some time in the future, when you have a problem, that's what you would call. If I had a B2B marketing agency, I would call it, in this specific buying situation, remember me. That would be our whole job. Our whole job is to tell you, is to work with a client to find out which buying situations they want to be thought of, and we'd help them to be remembered in creative messaging that delivered against that. So, I don't know, distinctive brand assets, 1,000%. You know, if you just had ads that had nothing else other than your color and your logos and your thing, and you communicated something, that would be better than the most creative thing that didn't have them. Don't put your logo at the end. Just put your logo on until people are just, you think that someone's going to vomit because they've seen too much of it. And then you're getting to about like maybe 5% of how much distinctive assets you need to use. I think in that sense, being distinctive is being thought of as memorable. But, you know, the Coke bottle, the original Coke bottle, and it has, you know, Coca-Cola and CRM systems have a couple of things in common. One is they're largely undifferentiated products. It's very difficult to sell brown fizzy drinks on the basis that they're brown and fizzy and sweet. You know, 50% fizzier than Pepsi is not what Coke tells you about its product. Similarly, many, many B2B products are somewhat undifferentiated and difficult to understand. And even if you did understand them, maybe you'd regret that you spent that bit of your life trying to grapple with all the different possibilities, and you're just reaching for satisfying. That's why brand matters, because it makes you feel something on top of the commoditized business. The Coke bottle was, this is what Mark Richardson tells you in the brand management course. It was designed such that if you picked it up, it had broken, you picked it up in the dark, you'd know that it was a Coca-Cola bottle. I think that's what distinctiveness is about. And differentiation means my product does something different. And, you know, maybe it does, but lots of products don't do different things. Lots of products do the same things and compete for the same people, and they compete in the same categories, and they're much of a muchness. And in our research, we found that whenever, you know, in any situation where there are a couple of different vendors who are much of a muchness or on a similar par, the most well-known, i.e. the biggest brand, was the one that got chosen. So brand is about undifferentiated products rather than differentiated products. But I wouldn't have a fight with Dame Trot about anything he said, because A, he's much more combative than I am, and B, he's completely right, and I'm probably completely wrong.
I wouldn't say that. I wouldn't say that you're completely wrong at all. Plus, I've got to know Dave quite well, and he won't mind me saying that he's getting on a bit now, so I think you could take him.
So you're just asking me to sign all my books that, you know.
There we go. Well, I like Remember Me. Our tagline here is actually creatively memorable and boringly effective. So it's not a million miles away from Remember Me. But I think that's a key point. And I think if I can nod back to Dave and his talk about the Von Restorff effect, which is really just highlighting the power of being distinct versus the competitive set, then maybe the creative choice of if you do that via media or any other means, I suppose there's an opportunity there to explore. But I guess it's... there's no absolute answer, as ever, to that question. But well done, well fielded. So Mimi, the final part of the interview is our four pertinent poses that we put to all of our guests. Starting with, what advice would you give to your younger self?
I find these questions very difficult because I have so many younger selves. You know, I used to be younger in lots of different versions of myself. But I don't know how much current Mimi has got to say to early Mimi. I bet if I, you know, some advice for myself of a year ago or 3 years ago or 5 years ago was probably much more useful to me on that iterative journey, like younger Mimi. I was just, you know, I don't think that I could say anything to younger Mimi that would be believable, other than, you know, unless I'd said, I should just give them some advice on what sporting bets to make and which stocks to buy. that would be super, super helpful.
Okay. There's like a Back to the Future 2 answer here. Sports almanac. Nice.
Yes, that's exactly it. That's exactly it. Yeah. Why didn't they just make it back, you know, buy Nvidia? That's what we should tell our younger selves. Yes.
Nice. Brilliant. If you could banish one thing from the industry, what would it be and why?
So I love the industry, and banishing things from an industry that, you know, captures both kind of creative, commercial, and beneficial is something I really want to do. I've sat in meetings. I would banish the bigger useless number. The bigger useless number, in my opinion, has never been shown the ejector seat as it ought to have been by comparison to a smaller but more useful number. So I would say, for instance, like I've been in many, many media environments. So follower numbers is a very big number. I think, you know, various different media platforms I've worked on probably say something between 22 trillion followers, or, you know, however many, but however big you can make that number, people make that number. But you know what's really important? Daily active users. That's actually really important. That's a number that I care about. I really don't care about the other numbers. The minute someone gives me a really big number, I now just think, you know, either you think I'm an idiot, or you're so clever that you realize this idiotic number travels much further in the world than it ought to. So I would banish the big, useless number. The B-U-N, get rid of it.
The B-U-N, the buns. Let's get rid of the buns. This, do you know what? That's never come up before, and it's an absolute belter. I'm delighted with that answer.
What do people usually say? Well,
it's a funny question, and perhaps we should actually rephrase this question, because the trouble with it is it sounds like it's coming from a place of hatred or disdain. And I suppose it probably was when I first wrote it, and I really needed to feel better about marketing. But it's meant to kind of uncover, you know, a reoccurring issue or stumbling block that our guests might have come up against. And I suppose people have given answers that are quite broad sometimes, and some that are quite specific. But this is very specific, but also I can imagine that bigger useless numbers get everywhere, and the power of numbers, especially as a nod back to Rory, who's come up a couple of times, they exist easily on spreadsheets and can influence decisions. So
And also they set a benchmarking heuristic, you know, like an imagination. If you ask somebody to imagine $18 trillion, they've already had some sort of serotonin rush at the thought that we can take a run at that. So, like, you know, going for a big TAM, like, all you see this all the time. You know, the TAM is $23 billion. Great, our revenue is $7 million. Which TAM do we have 30 to 60%? And that's our TAM. We're not in the $83 billion TAM if our revenue is $7 million. And just saying $83 billion does not make us in that category. So yeah.
Absolutely. I fear there's more bigger useless numbers than either of us may have anticipated when you first gave that answer. Well, I'm now imagining them everywhere.
Look out for them, and then you can just tag me on LinkedIn if you meet any other big useless numbers. And we could just ask people to recommend their biggest useless numbers.
It's a great show. It's a great show.
Number three, then, are there any books that you could recommend to our listeners? And just for clarity, these can be fiction or non-fiction.
I'm going to give you the book that I'm reading right now on the basis that I've been telling everybody about it.
Okay.
So it's a book of speeches. It's literally just speeches of the 19th and 20th century, mainly 20th century, from like pockets of history that I just completely missed. I think between Cleopatra, the Vikings, and the Tudors, you know, that's like in the 80s and 90s, that's where, if you didn't do history as an exam subject, that's where it ended. So there's like just giant spaces that I don't have. And it's an anthology by Brian MacArthur, who used to be on the Sunday Times, where I was first as a journalist. And the book is about, it's a collection of speeches about things that changed the world. And as a reader, we have this advantage, which is we know things that the protagonist doesn't know. So Emmeline Pankhurst in 1908 doesn't know that in 1918, women will get the vote. David Lloyd George gives a speech about why Britain should enter the First World War, doesn't know in 1909 what's going to happen. So we know something that the protagonists don't know. But what's really interesting about the book is that it is essentially a model for how those people won profound social change, whether it's the Boer War or Ireland or the First World War or female emancipation. The way that change, this is a book of the winners. They won that game. Lots of people didn't win the game of change, but these people won the game of change. And they all won, not by doing the thing that we do now, which is articulating the aggravation with the mothership and the unfairness and the victimology of being outside that system. That's what we actually do now. We have a really strong discourse about unfairness. But interesting to observe, if no more than that, that the people here actually win, the data set of winners, the model that they set up, and obviously they all did it separately at different times, and it only comes through when you read 50 of them at the same time. The winning model is to say to the, you know, to the establishment from whom one is seeking change, not we are right and you're wrong and you should try to be more right because otherwise you're meanies. That's a failing model. The successful model is to say, we believe in freedom and fairness for this group of people, and you also believed that at some previous time in your evolution because you did exactly the same for this group of people that we are asking for that group of people. You did it before and now we seek to do it now. If you make that case cannot be fought. It simply cannot be lost. Your virtue and beliefs about liberty allowed this fairness on which you've based your identity, mothership. We seek exactly that for this right now. That's what wins. That's why Emmeline Pankhurst secured the vote for women because she said, the system, you've left it to all the women of the world to seek their own destiny and to make their own future. But you yourselves do not apply those same rules to you. The rules for men are different from the rules for women. We seek only what's fair for men. That's how you actually get change. You have to persuade the people from whom you're seeking change to see that your situation is a situation that they themselves have been in. That's progress. That is how progress happened. It might not be how we want to agree on progress happening, but it's how progress happened. Revolution is a different thing. If you want to have a revolution, that's a whole different book. But if you want to understand how change really happens, that's a very different discourse from the discourse we have now, which is you are bad people for believing this, and we believe that we are right or you are wrong. That just leads to a fracture and a failure. And I would say there's a fracture and a failure in our politics at a local level, at a global level. And that's because we don't understand that difference is not how we proceeded to be successful. That's a very long exposition of the book. The book is called The Penguin Book of Modern Speeches, but it is just a recipe for winning.
Yeah, no, it sounds fantastic. And again, pleasingly for me, from a, I suppose, a vanity metric of sorts, is that this book has not come up before either by Brian MacArthur. So that will also be linked, but it sounds fantastic. The trouble with doing this podcast, Mimi, is I now own even more books than I did previously that I still haven't read because they're always, it's always so compelling.
I gave you the high-level précis. You don't have to read the book now, although the book is a very nice, like, Alice in Wonderland journey from the Cheshire Cat to the Mad Hatter's Tea Party to this to that. But the thing is, if you want to change, if you want to negotiate for change, you're much more likely to be successful negotiating for that change by pointing to the people that you want to change, that they believe what you believe, and that your belief postdates their belief, and you're just wanting them to believe what they already believe.
Yeah. Yeah, fantastic. I can't fault that kind of behavioural logic at all. Sounds fantastic.
But we don't do it, Giles. We don't do it. We say, you're rubbish for not understanding these. We argue much too much about rightness and wrongness because we want the other people to be wrong. That's the problem. I think that one of the things that we are, you know, that 21st century politics is very much about wanting other people to be wrong. We want our enemies to be wrong. Whereas if we understood that to some extent our enemies and us are doing the same things for the same reasons for slightly different groups of people, we wouldn't have as many enemies.
No, and I think the sentiment is perfect. We actually had, for a short period of time, we had a spin-off series of Call to Action called They Might Be Right. And it was in homage to Bill Birnbach, who famously, albeit the stories vary slightly, used to carry a card around in his pocket, which simply read, They Might Be Right. And he would reach for it whenever he found himself in a conversation of conflict. And it would buy him sufficient amount of time to explore the differing points of view, knowing full well that some good could come from it. So the They Might Be Right series, we used to step in on marketing Twitter spats and invite the people debating loyalty or whatever it was to come and host a civilized debate, just so we could all explore the grayscale that ultimately the answer often lands in. And it was lovely. But I mean, I suppose one of the side effects of Elon Musk blowing up Twitter is that these spats don't happen as regularly, so we've only had a few episodes. But I think the sentiment is exactly right, and it's important in a day where it's too easy to like or not, and these kind of absolute social media metrics that we're almost forced into. I think it's important to explore the grayscale. Fantastic. But then number four, Mimi, is we always dedicate every episode to someone, and we bestow or hospital pass that honour, depending on your view, to our guest who has to give their reason why. So would you dedicate this episode?
Well, that's a tough question, but I think actually it's not a tough question. I dedicate it first to two people that I've worked with who've made a profound impact on my professional life. One is Jan, who is a kind of a tour de force in future thinking and has a kind of incredible and uncanny ability to visualize more than I can. And I find that that's both incredibly elevating and sometimes quite depressing, but it nonetheless it that creates a sort of like a very profound dynamic that allows us to do things that individually I don't think we'd be able to do. And I think the other person would be Roger Martin, who has, I think, Roger worked closely with now in the last 3 years, but also really did create a foundation of thinking that allowed me to have a clear view as opposed to a fuzzy view. And I think clarity of vision allows us to be less confused. And that state of being confused and not knowing one way or another is really, really painful. So I think Jan and Roger, both in their own way, have really helped frame and deepen my possibilities of thinking.
Fantastic. That's a fantastic dedication. This episode is very proudly dedicated to Jan Schwartz and Roger Martin. Amazing. Mimi, I can't thank you enough. You've given us everything from the Penguin Book of Modern Speeches to, I'm just going through my notes and my scorings here. So we've got hidden buyers, big brands winning by accident, getting rid of bigger useless numbers, risk mitigation, brand is for now, heated steering wheels. I've doodled like a lunatic here. The world's worst chambermaid. I've gone back to the beginning now. That was a highlight of sorts for me at the start. But it's been wonderful. We will link, of course, to the research that you've recently shared with Jan, and we will equally link to previous work, including your Nudge Stock talk that you did a little over a year ago, which centered on making a promise to the customer. So I'll urge everyone listening to check all of that out. How else can our guests get more Mimi Turner?
I feel perhaps they get just the right amount of Mimi Turner, or in, if they wanted to kind of reach out on LinkedIn, or, you know, kind of if any of the subjects in this conversation, and it's been a great conversation, Giles, are of interest, then I think reaching out to myself or to Jan Schwartz, because we really say, or to Jamie and Claire Cornett Bain, we really think that we are on the precipice of discovering a profound new paradigm for B2B marketing, which is badly named and therefore doesn't allow you to know how to win. B2B marketing is buyer group marketing. And when groups of people make decisions, much more is at stake than when an individual makes a decision. And until we accept that as the reality, we won't really be able to be right. We'll be right by accident if we're the biggest brands, and we'll be wrong, sadly, when we could be righter if we're not the biggest brand. And my whole approach is to try and create an opportunity to win. That's it. You know, if it's not winnable, there's no point. One of the problems in marketing is that generally the solution is to spend more money, right? One of the reasons that the customer promise worked so good is it was a creative thing that meant you got better results without spending any more money. It wasn't about having a fair advantage. It's about having an unfair advantage. Understanding who you're really trying to reach when most people don't is an unfair advantage. Understanding how to reach them when most people don't is an unfair advantage. So the Department of Unfair Advantage might itself be unfair, but life is really hard, and life is never harder than for smaller brands. So they need all the unfair advantages that we can get. Smaller brands and challenge brands. I'm there to try and change the odds of winning on that. And I think these two ideas and this new paradigm are going to help tremendously, because they mean that winning is more achievable, and it's winning is a strategic thing, not a budget thing.
Mimi, thank you so much for joining us. It's been an absolute pleasure.
I've enjoyed it tremendously too. And Giles, you've been very, very generous, and you made me feel very welcome. And as I say, definitely one of the world's worst chambermaids, but I think maybe in the world's top 10 million towel folders in yeah. Hemisphere. Or in Europe, let's just say. In Europe.
In Europe. Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's been on this podcast. Let's limit that pool even more. Fantastic. Finally, thank you to everyone listening. If you've enjoyed this episode, please do share and review the podcast. Keep your questions and guest requests coming in. To get in touch, it's easy to find Gasp online, or you can email the mouthful, that is calltoaction@gasp.agency.
I try. I can't get no call to action. Oh, I can't get no call to action. Yeah.
We interrupt this podcast to announce that we will never interrupt this podcast with ads. Ads that awkwardly nudge you to contact the... Sorry.